Welcome to Nightlife, the first hour.
Laura, why don't we listen up to this? The beautiful, beautiful music of Mozart. Mozart, of course, in the Marriage of Figaro Overture. Mozart was an example of a true child prodigy. He began composing music by the age of three. By the time he was 12, he'd clocked up 10 symphonies and performed for royalty. Well, they're a rare thing. A child prodigy is thought to emerge in less than 1% of the population. But then we have children who are deemed to be gifted, and that's possibly 10% of students in Australian schools. How do we define these things anyway? We're going to explore the world of prodigies and gifted children tonight. The definition of what each word is, of course, is contentious, and there's debate, and properly so, I guess, about what constitutes a prodigy and what's defined as gifted. And where do our gifted and child prodigies end up? In the end, do a lot of people catch up with them? Do they live successful lives? We'll explore some of that. You might have seen a while ago the ABC TV show, still available on iView, by the way, Making Child Prodigies. Alan Thompson was the consultant and advisor to that show that followed five extraordinarily talented Australian children and their families. And he's my guest tonight. Alan, welcome to the program.
Hey, Phil, how you going?
Not bad. Welcome to Nightlife. Also joining us tonight, Melinda Gindy. Melinda's the president of the Australian Association for the Education of the Gifted and Talented. Melinda, good evening to you and welcome to Nightlife.
Good evening, Philip, and hello, Alan.
Yes.
Hi, Melinda, how are you?
Yeah, great. Well, great to have both of you on. Now, Melinda, I want to preface everything at the beginning by saying I appreciate you very much for joining us tonight when you probably should be out celebrating with your friends because it's your birthday. So happy birthday.
Thanks so much, Phil. Thank you.
Alan, to you first. These terms are bandied about, aren't they? Gifted children and prodigies. We use the term all the time, don't we? Describing someone who's got a talent as being something of a prodigy, but if they're young. Is there any actual definition? How do we define it anyway?
Yeah, you're right to say it's a bit contentious. I suppose in academic circles it's a bit more well understood, but given the rarity of both of these groups, we get some different definitions. The formal definition of a prodigy in the simplest terms is a child who performs at the level of an expert adult. So think of your 9-year-old golfer who is playing at a master's level, maybe towards Tiger Woods level. It sounds absurd, but these guys do exist. And I'm not sure I'd say it would be a percentage, like 1% of the population, but some of the academics put that down as 1 in a million, perhaps.
Hmm. Yeah, and I mentioned, that's right, less, maybe 1% or less than the population. What does that amount to in a country like Australia, for example?
Well, for prodigies, if it's 1 in a million and we're just looking at the under 10s, because these are generally defined as children under 10, it's going to be very, very, very rare. Obviously, you might say there's 4 or 5 available in Australia. That would be my rough guess. The prodigies appear usually in 4 major fields. We're talking about art or music or mathematics or chess. And there's possibly not even any in those fields in some parts of the world, maybe not even in Australia. So very, very different to giftedness, which is more widely accepted. And obviously there's a larger population of those. And
yeah, I was going to ask you about that because so the skills which they have, which prodigies have, don't tend to be they tend to be relatively narrow, do they?
They can be, yeah. There's a lot of polyglots, so there's a lot of...
We don't get 5-year-olds writing novels, for example, but we do get them solving complicated mathematical problems.
I think you might actually find children who write novels at 5 years old. You certainly can find composers like Mozart as a great example, more modern examples of those who are writing symphonies and operas at 9 years old. You'll certainly find painters at 5 years old. There was a very famous painter in India, a six-year-old boy who created 25,000 paintings in different ways. So they're out there. They might not be top of mind. They might not even be in the media, but they are very high performance.
Yeah. What's the difference between a prodigy and a gifted child?
So again, the prodigy's one in a million. Gifted, we might say, the widely accepted definition, including in the Australian education system, is one in 10.
What does it mean? If you say a prodigy is a person, a child working at an expert adult level, is it before the age of something? Can you be a prodigy when you're 12 or 13?
Yeah, again, contentious, Phil. So most say adolescent, before adolescence, 10, 11, 12-ish, and then they fall out of that particular category. Intellectually gifted children, or giftedness as a whole, is a lot more broad. We're talking about those who have abilities that put them in the top, say, 10% of their age peers. And so you'd probably define that with an IQ test, but it means, as you've said previously, that it might be 400,000 gifted students here in Australia, or maybe closer to 600 or 700,000 children in general here in Australia that would fall into that classification of gifted.
So they're the smart kids. They're the smart kids in their peer group, in other words.
Yeah, I mean, they can still be underachieving. We're not talking about academic performance here. We're talking about a different way of thinking, a different capacity. And again, the distinction is giftedness is this potential, whereas a prodigy is someone that is performing, someone who's converted that into talent.
In the way that Mozart was, that's right, at the age of seven, performing publicly on the piano and other instruments and composing music. Melinda, you're president of the Australian Association for the Education of the Gifted and Talented. How do you define gifted?
Yeah, so giftedness in Australia, as Alan has mentioned, we're looking at the model that's in existence across all state and territory jurisdictions in Australia looks at giftedness as being that top 10% of high potential or natural ability across multiple domains, so intellectual, creative, social, emotional and physical domains.
I mean, I said they're the smartest kids in their peer group. Is that what you would say they are, or is it defined in some other way?
Look, it depends what we say is smart. I think giftedness in and of itself is that
they perform the best in tests and examinations in abilities.
So in Australia we recognize that as talent. And that performance, that high performance and achievement, we recognise as talent. Where we see that in Australia is as differentiated from giftedness, where it's that natural innate ability that is not necessarily manifested in talent. And so what we look at and what we need to consider, as a country throughout our education systems is how we're able to support that manifestation of, talent. Ability into talent.
How do you recognise it anyway?
Phil, there's multiple ways that we can be looking at identification of students, and that can be through objective ways. As Alan's already mentioned, in terms of that IQ assessment and finding that ability. And then, of course, it's subjective measures as well that we can be looking at. But it's not that there is actually one checklist for gifted. In actual fact, a child may or may not be able to read early. They may or may not be able to, engage in high-level musical constructs, that sort of thing.
Yeah, you've had some personal experience of this because you've got a child about to be a teenager who's classified as gifted. How did you recognise it?
So I actually have a background in music teaching, particularly in secondary education. I actually don't have a lot of experience with the young children, and so when my eldest was hitting those age two, age three, I did not recognise him initially as being, I guess one would say, different from his neurotypical peers. Mm. It was our family's normal because it was what we were seeing in a family. So I didn't really realise that things that he was doing, the innate, thirst he had for learning and things that he was creating and designing and working out and calculating was actually far beyond his neurotypical peers. And it actually was his preschool teacher that came to me so we were in a really blessed situation, and that sort of started my journey, my initial journey from being an educator in music to actually moving into the field of gifted education.
Mm. But how did you recognise in him that he had talents that were out of the ordinary for his peer group?
A few things that I saw in him, which are, not necessarily the same case as other students, but I didn't actually realise that a three-year-old is not supposed to be able to do a 300-piece puzzle. Mm. That he taught himself to read way before going to school. He had, as I said, that insatiable knowledge. I would wake up in the morning and he'd already be down on our family's computer, playing around with some of the cool maths games and things like that. And they were looking back. They were our first sons, very alert baby, climbing ladders at 11, those sort of things. Now, that's what was for him. That's his individual, strengths or personality that came through.
Alan, is it about... I'm just trying to get to, again, this measurement definition issue. Is it about IQ? I mean, IQ, of course, has had massive critics, hasn't it, because of its various biases, cultural biases amongst others. Is IQ a measure of prodigies and giftedness?
Yeah, again, we could probably talk about this all night, Phil.
we've got some of the night. Let's go.
And you're right, there is controversy. IQ is the best we've got right now for measuring intellectual giftedness. Mm. And with the norms that are happening now, with some of the advanced assessments by Wechsler and by Stanford Binet, I mean, that has been around for 120 years or so. That's normed in countries, including here in Australia and New Zealand, where we can compare children with children. So if you think of IQ just as comparisons within age groups of mental capacity, of cognitive function, then that's a pretty good way to measure it, but only to the extent that we can measure height and weight. So once we've got that metric, it's time to actually do something with it and convert it to talent.
Okay, so gifted and prodigies have IQs where?
Well, let's say gifted, we're using our Australian education definition, is in the top 10%. So that would be an IQ of about 120. Once we get to the top 2%, we're looking at an IQ of about 130, and then our top 1% is 140 plus as an IQ. And again, that's within age ranges, so that will be just for that age population. Prodigies, back to this contentious discussion, the research is that they don't necessarily have to be gifted, so they might not even have an IQ that flags at 130, 140, They do have an extraordinary memory, so that will measure in the 99th percentile. But because we're looking at so many different domains, including the art, music, maths, chess, but it could also expand to cooking or sports or dance, that might not necessarily reflect across some of the different subtests inside IQ testing.
Yes, I mean, there used to be a term, I'm not even sure it's in use anymore, in the past, called idiosavants, for example, where mm-hmm. people had a prodigious talent, but it was a talent. It might be a talent for reciting, the pie to 100 places from memory, for example, or it might be a talent for playing music backwards, example, or speaking backwards. This is not what we're talking about, though, is it, or is it?
No, look, savants are going to be just a little bit different. They can be related to prodigies. And in fact, research out of America with Professor Dr. Joanne Ruthsatz found that prodigies do share a genetic etiology with individuals with autism, but these two groups are just slightly different.
All right, we're talking about child prodigies and gifted and talented people tonight with Alan Thompson, founder of Life Architect, a life coaching practice which supports high-ability families, and Melinda Gindy too, state president of the of a gifted families support group. Does it run in the family, Melinda? Are, the, are your other children also also in this particular bracket or not?
Phil, research is a little bit inconclusive of that, but there is some research to suggest that siblings are within 10 IQ points. In our family's case, they are.
Okay, so would you say that there's only one of your children who is, or because I
can't... No. All three are well above and within that 10%.
Tell me about your organisation. Why is there an organisation for gifted?
The Australian Association for the Education of Gifted and Talented exists to promote and support giftedness at all levels. Mm-hmm. And as a national association, we want to ensure that the voice and the awareness raising of gifted education is sustained at that national level. We do that through various events and working within
When you say support, why do they need support? What needs supporting here? I mean, some listening might think, well, gee, that's terrific. That's fantastic. They're obviously, they can obviously cope with the work, etc. So let them get on with it.
Well, that's an interesting statement because, in actual fact, giftedness is not necessarily a golden lottery ticket. There is actually no guarantee of success and engagement for gifted children, and that's part of the work of the AAGT to, demyth and debunk some of those beliefs in society that, the gifted kids will be right on their own. Just leave them. They're okay. And they do need to be recognised. They do need their abilities, talents nurtured in a welcoming and positive environment. And, based on their readiness to learn. And, for example, acceleration. We look at acceleration and we look at the research behind acceleration. And in actual fact, they're up to sort of 20 different forms of acceleration. But, as a construct, I believe that in Australia, that particular support mechanism for gifted and talented students is really under-realized and under-utilized in our country.
Alan, does what happen? Melinda, please chime in here too. Just picking up that point of yours that just because you're good when you're seven doesn't mean you'll be a successful and gifted adult necessarily. Miranda has texted me too, saying, "Phil, our son was diagnosed with being gifted and talented when he was six, and had taught himself to read at the age of three. He had an IQ of 147. He coasted through school, dropped out of uni at the age of 27, is drifting. How can we help him? His thinking's definitely on a higher plane, but he can't seem to convert it, i.e. apply it. What now?" Raises an interesting point here, Alan, doesn't it? Do gifted and talented people stay gifted and talented, or do other people... In other words, they can do things at seven, which people can do at 20, for example. By the time they're 20, have most others caught up?
Well, I'm not really sure.
I mean, in other words, are they still the brightest in the group and the smartest in the group at that age? I mean, or in other words, do things even out as people grow and develop?
Yeah, look, a major discussion point inside this entire field is finding that optimal environment where they're supported. And it's not just education, it's not just school. That's a very small slice of the pie. It's inside parenting, it's inside behavioral management, it's inside allowing them to understand their strengths and their values and the way that they learn. So really allowing them to understand more of that will ensure that they have that performance right the way through the lifespan. And in my experience, those that stop those that fail or those that kind of go backwards as they get older have not been given those resources and have not been allowed to exist in an optimal environment, which I know is a big ask and, again, quite a major discussion point.
Mm. Yeah, but just more to that question, though, do gifted and talented people, are they always more gifted and talented? Melinda, do you have anything to add to that?
Yeah, look, I think I really agree with what Alan's saying there, and it's that optimization of giftedness to talents. And you know, giftedness, as we're understanding it to be that natural ability or that potential, really, really should not change. But it's the manifestation of that talent. And we think about it this way, Philip, if we think about Ian Thorpe. So I don't think any of our listeners tonight would agree that it would have been a much better course of action to leave young Ian Thorpe training, say, in the kiddie pool, simply because the kiddie pool had swimmers his own age. You know, as it makes sense for for Ian to have progressed to training based on his readiness to learn, so it makes sense for students who are gifted in the intellectual domain to progress based on their readiness to learn and to be considering, okay, what are the catalysts? You know, one field, my field of passion is actually what the research literature describes as twice exceptional. And twice exceptional, these are the students that are not, you know, twice as smart or twice as too gifted, so gifted at maths and gifted at music, for example. Twice exceptional are these students who are gifted, and that's one exceptionality to their neurotypical peers. And the second exceptionality is that they have a learning disability. And ensuring that we support, nurture that learning disability based on remediation and adjustments to learning, part of recognising, understanding that and putting those things in place actually helps the manifestation of that giftedness into talent. So if there is something else going on for that child, that's one of those, you know, environmental and optimization elements that Alan was mentioning earlier that needs to come into play and needs to be considered.
Let's talk about some of the greatest child prodigies. I mentioned Mozart, of course. And Stevie Wonder. We could also mention Alma Deutsch, couldn't we? Tell me about Alma Deutscher.
Alma's one of my favourites, Phil. Alma was raised, like a lot of these prodigies, by very, very differently, let me get my language right here, by parents that had different genes and also in a different environment. So Alma was raised by a linguist by the name of Guy Deutscher, and he never taught Alma the colour of the sky. And he's got a very famous book about how he avoided that and how he allowed her to define her understanding of colour and understanding of objects. Through those cool genes, if you like, and through the environment that she was allowed to thrive in, she started playing piano and violin at the age of 3. She wrote her first opera at the age of 7. You can watch a great video on YouTube of her performing at Google in front of Stephen Hawking, both the violin and the piano, and then talking about her process, including her process of almost divining her music through dreams and through intuition. So very, very high performance. She's been, compared to Mozart, fascinating person. She's now 15 years old and she's very high profile in the media. So if you wanted to have a look for more info,
yeah, well,
on
let's
her,
hear
she's a great
let's example. Let's hear something about it. She was also that's right, she's been in the media a bit. She was on the Ellen Show. This is Alma Deutscher on the Ellen DeGeneres Show.
You were 7 years old when the music started coming to you, and it was a dream at first, right?
Well, yes, the beginning of my opera came as a dream. I dreamt that it was a beautiful piece by Mozart, which he had written. But when I woke up, then it turned out that I had actually thought it's actually me who thought about it in my dream. And I played it down on the piano, and my father recorded me before I wrote it down in pencil so that I would remember it.
So you're going to play the violin for us today. What song are you playing today?
I'm playing The Bee by Schubert. The violin is playing the buzzing of the bee.
Right. Okay.
Thank you.
She's got some virtuoso skills. There's no doubt about that. Tell me a bit about we have homegrown prodigies here too. Terence Tao is a mathematician. Tell me about him.
Another media darling, Phil. This guy is all through the newspapers, and he has been since the late 1980s. Professor Mirica Gross from the University of New South Wales there in Sydney really helped with his development. He has an IQ of around 200, so we're talking about the 99.999th percentile, really, really high stuff, incomparable, really. When we use the old metric of converting IQ to age, you could say that his mental age was twice his chronological age. And that's one of the reasons that he went to Flinders University at 9 years old. He effectively had a mental age of 18 years old. He's now a professor at UCLA. He actually became a full professor there at 24, and is one of the two Australian Fields Medal Award winners, which is the equivalent of the Nobel Prize.
The Fields Medal in Maths is the equivalent of the Nobel Prize. It's an extraordinarily difficult thing to win and a great honour. Yes, that's right. He's been described, I was reading about him today, he's been described as, there's almost nobody, mathematicians say, who would know the whole of mathematics. That is, the whole of the scope of mathematics, because it's so broad. He may be one of them. As someone said, if he doesn't know about something, he will by tomorrow.
Yeah, just an extraordinary brain. And to have him homegrown, as you said, he's out of Adelaide, and to have him here for so long until the brain drain took him away from us into California is just amazing. So he's part of a lot of research that Mirica has undertaken for a number of decades, and that's held by the university at UNSW there.
What about William James Sidis, who didn't enjoy his prodigy status?
Yeah, not a great story there, but another really exceptional story. If you want to talk about the peak of prodigies, this guy was around in the very early 1900s. Some of the documented evidence says that he had an IQ of 300, which would be the highest IQ ever. Is that even possible? Yeah. I don't know how many nines you'd put on that 99.9, but you would say that he had a mental age of about three times his chronological age. He was reading the New York Times, the newspaper, when he was just 18 months old. He went and learnt eight different languages by the time he was 8 years old. And then he created his own language out of thin air and documented that. It's a fascinating language. By the time he was nine, while Terry Tao went to Flinders at nine, William actually went to Harvard, and then he became a lecturer there by the time he was 12 years old.
He was lecturing at Harvard when he was 12.
He was lecturing at professor level by the time he was 12. Just exceptional. Then something kind of all went wrong, and this is really back to the environment. He was raised by two doctors, including a very famous psychiatrist, but without having like-minded peers, probably without having a few of the slices of pie that we mentioned, including proper parenting, people around him that can support him, one of the endless resources that would be required for a brain like William's, he really just sat back. He spent a long time working for government. He was able to operate two calculators, one in each hand at the same time. And then he got obsessed with tracking tram schedules and designing these interchanges for efficient movement of trams, such that by the time he was in his late 20s, he'd essentially given up, and he died quite early in his 40s. So for me, that's one of the really kind of bad luck stories or a warning story of what can happen when we have this immense capacity. Three times mental age, that's unimaginable, but we don't manage it properly or we don't give the right resources and the right provisions.
Okay, one of my texters says, I was a gifted and talented child, actually twice exceptional. I'm also dysgraphic. I'm now a completely unremarkable adult. Since graduating uni, I've worked in cafes and aged care. I think the whole thing's silly. Yeah, Melinda, is there a danger in labelling children at all in this way, do you think, or not?
Philip, I honestly, through my observations and as the research suggests, that it's not about labelling. It's about a child understanding themselves. And the reality is that students know, or children know, that they're different. It just, even watching my own children and my eldest that I spoke about, they know that they're different. And being able to understand, and, you know, that giftedness doesn't actually mean that they're more special. They're not more special than any other children. But in reality...
Although by using that word, that's a highly loaded word, isn't it? When we're saying they're more special, aren't we?
They're not. No, absolutely not.
This is what I'm saying about the labelling, though. Is the language here wrong?
See, if we think that giftedness in itself, just in that label, or that title, is elitist, then perhaps yes. But the reality is, when we have a look at what giftedness means, what we're talking about in the educational and the research literature, it's that advancement of, you know, cognitive ability that is simply just beyond what might be expected for one's age in any of those domains that we were talking about. So it's that's what we got to sort of break down in society, that, you know, you put whatever name you like it on itself. Even if you change the name and got rid of the terminology gifted and just suddenly called it something else, if we're referencing these students that have, or these children that have, this innate natural ability, whatever name you give it, it's going to is going to give that. But it's how you support it, and how you recognise it, and how you celebrate it. The reality is that there are often other learners who are identified as in our federal and our state education acts, and when that identification is incorporated into legislation, often other things follows, but the reality is that the failure to include gifted students in that identification in that legislation means that Australia is actually lacking a national vision. It's lacking national resourcing, or even state resourcing for that matter, and there's a huge gap in supporting teachers in initial education to be equipped to nourish and support these 400,000 plus learners that are in our schools. And, Phil, you sort of led in this session this evening with a reference to what is happening in Europe and the devastating situation we have in COVID. Well, all those people currently working behind the scenes on a vaccine for COVID, who were they as children? These are the gifted children all grown up. These are the children who are likely to have been engaged in school. They're likely to have been... their learning needs being met in terms of depth and complexity and engagement, and they're likely to have been supported in an Opta environment, gone on to med school, and these are the kids we need.
All right. Melinda Gindy's with us, State President of a Gifted Family Support Group, and Alan Thompson is with us as well, a life coach supporting high-ability families. We're talking about the lives of prodigies and gifted and talented children. Alan, you say that the talents of these children shouldn't be classified as a gift.
Look, I think the capacity that we've talked about, the giftedness, can lead on to talents. I'm not sure whether any of the words that have been selected in this field do benefit anyone. I mean, these guys are not being given a gift. As Melinda said, they don't consider themselves special, and they don't want to be considered special. Mm. We could say the same thing about the word acceleration. Well, they're not looking to go faster than anyone or get around anyone. They're really looking to release the brakes. Mm. So I don't know if a change of terminology would help. There's certainly references to high ability rather than giftedness. And then we do actually use that phrase, releasing the brakes rather than acceleration. I think it could all be... just skirting around the issue. And the issue is that these children are like all children. They need to be allowed to have their abilities endorsed, promoted. They need to be brought up in the right environment, and they need to be allowed to fulfill their potential, as simple as that sounds.
Let's take some calls. Chris, g'day.
Hi. I'm a high school math teacher.
Yep.
And I've got a academic year 10 group, and obviously they're looking at year 11 subjects. Now, I've sort of always taken the view with your gifted students, haven't been one labelled as one myself, that you sort of let them do the subjects that they're interested in. However, I'm facing backlash from my school that they want me to push students into doing certain subjects. What's the thoughts of the panelists on that?
Melinda, do you want to have a crack at that?
Yeah, that's an interesting one. There is that fine balance between raising the bar and
yep.
challenging our students and
yep.
working out on an individual level what's going on for them that they
yep.
want to nestle back down. Now,
yep.
the reality is, and what we've been talking about tonight, is that giftedness manifests in multiple domains. So that
yep.
doesn't necessarily mean that students who have been identified as gifted are actually going to have a passion for mathematics. And
mm-hmm.
I highly respect that to you as a maths teacher. They may actually want to be investing their time in other fields of excellence, perhaps,
yeah.
for example, advanced English. And so I would encourage that discussion on an individual level about
yeah.
Where is the drive and the investment that student wants to make. Because
yeah.
I think as a society, I think it's wrong for us to say, okay, you're gifted, therefore we have this expectation of you that you will go in, you will achieve this ATAR of 99 and you'll go into what's considered to be, say, these top, you know, academic based
yeah.
fields.
Yeah.
So there is that fine.
Sorry,
go ahead.
Chris, go on.
Yeah. So what you said was actually very right. I mean, the group that I've got has not actually been challenged, and they get me this year and I've suddenly said, no, I'm going to be challenging you. And now it's suddenly like, oh, you know, we're not automatically going to get an A. We're not automatically going to pass. You know, it's like you've actually now got to demonstrate that higher level and all that. So,
yeah, Chris, when you were labelled this way as a kid, did you feel as though you were given... When Melinda talks about support, I mean, some listening might think, well, surely a teacher faced with a talented kid in the class gives that talented kid some more difficult books to read or some more complicated
yeah.
mathematical problems to solve. Or, in other words, all teachers do this, don't they? They teach
mm.
according to a student's ability?
Yeah, generally. I mean, in maths, a lot of schools do tend to stream. I mean, when I was at high school, I was actually part of a group of academic extension students. So
yeah.
we were all basically pushed into the same subject. And like was said, some students didn't actually enjoy those subjects and then failed them, you know, whereas others excelled. So I could sort of see why I don't want to push my students into doing the top-level maths if they haven't got that interest in doing it, because I think that sort of breeds resentment in some ways with those students as well.
Well, yeah, exactly. All right, Chris, thank you, and thanks for the call as well. But we're talking about gifted and talented children, and even whether that terminology is what we ought to be using, with Melinda Gindy, who's the president of a gifted family support group, and Alan Thompson, life coach as well. What do you say about this, Alan? Do you some listening might say, well, look, won't people who have above average abilities, like well above average abilities, what people are calling twice exceptional and perhaps greater, won't they in a sense find their own opportunities with the right teachers who can give them more complex material?
Yeah, I think Melinda was beautifully eloquent there, that really once they've listened to and once they have identified what they actually want to do, then away they go, and you can't be more diplomatic than that. I'd consider being a bit more rough around the edges and thinking about where we are right now in 2020, and that the children born today will be in the workforce perhaps in 2060, 2070, setting themselves up for retirement in 2080, 2090. And if we consider the best of the best gifted schools, if you like, One of those is Elon Musk's gifted school out of California. The principal there is Joshua Dahn. The students there are allowed to select and effectively say no to any subject that they don't want to do. Joshua, I suppose, with Elon's blessing, has chosen not to teach language, not to teach music, not to teach sports, and as of next year, not to teach mathematics. So these guys are really looking to the future, and it sounds futuristic to say, let's think about where they'll be in 2080, 2090, but that's the reality of the guys that are being born as we speak. And just fascinating. So think about the kind of things that will be of interest then, and also think about the extra benefits that we'll have available to us. You know, the same way that the iPhone would have sounded futuristic, the fact that we've got a video and a camera and a phone and a complete access to the sum of humanity's entire knowledge for the last few centuries right there on our hip pocket. What will we have available in the next few decades? And is teaching mathematics a good use of their time? So I'd encourage, there's a free resource for listeners to have a look at. This is Elon's school. It's a website called astronova.org. I'd encourage listeners to have a look at the videos there and the kind of ethics conundrums that are being taught to these students to allow them to think bigger. We're not talking about STEM. We're talking way past that. We're not even talking about creativity and communication anymore. We're talking about something much bigger. And in some ways, we're kind of guessing what they won't need and perhaps what they will need.
Paul. Hello, Paul.
Good evening, Philip. How are you?
Well, thank you.
Good. Just a quick question. Alan Turing, I'm sure your panel's heard of that. Yeah,
Alan Turing, yes, the decoder of the Enigma.
What sort of bracket would he put in him? As a child prodigy, gifted, or a genius?
I don't know.
Say for his time.
I don't know, Alan. You're familiar with Alan Turing?
Love Alan Turing. Yeah, absolutely. Look, we'd probably put him in the gifted bracket for sure. We did have measurements around when he was born, the early 1900s, the first Stanford Binet was coming out, but I don't think we have an actual IQ metric. We would also probably put him in the genius bracket, and the difference between genius and gifted is quite similar between the gifted and prodigy, in that genius is a high performance version of that giftedness. Again, giftedness, just ability and potential or capacity. And then genius is this talent come to life, this performance.
One of the things that, of course, is the mark of successful people in life is not just their IQ, though, is it, Alan and Melinda? It's also their ability to get on with people. I mean, in terms of making a successful life for yourself, you know, all from forming relationships to having rewarding careers and so on. Do we sometimes throw the EQ out with the bathwater because of the IQ, Melinda?
Look, we're at risk as society of doing that, but you know, we need to be considering that, you know, engaging and supporting, you know, the whole child or the whole development of the individual includes that well-being and that being well. And often, you know, as a society, we sometimes consider, okay, you know, the students on advanced placement, or, you know, connecting the 10-year-old, you know, into year 12, year 11 maths, for example, that there's a disconnect there. But often the engagement factor is actually increased because they're with their same age cognitive peers. And so therefore that emotional nurturing actually comes from that perspective as well. And just to wrap back around in terms of what you said in success, the question then is, well, how do we measure success? And I think that
can be measured in all sorts of ways, can't it? Yeah, but go on.
And that's exactly it. They're measured in all sorts of ways. So an individual might consider their success as, say, obtaining the answer to quantum physics, whereas another individual might determine their success to be, having actually mentored a individual out of a sad and emotionally draining situation. So there's your different measures of success there.
Well, another person might consider themselves successful because they maintained a long and loving relationship, for example.
Absolutely.
And they would be right to think that too.
Oh, absolutely. And this is why I think so much that the model that we use in Australia is really important, because it doesn't recognise giftedness as only being in that intellectual domain or in that sporting domain. You know, there is also the creative domain, social, emotional domain. And thank goodness that we as a society have this these ability levels and this talent development across those multiple domains. Because, you know, if we're all mathematicians, I'd hate to see what our society looks like.
Yes, well, although my mathematician friends tell me that maths is in everything in life, even your mobile, especially in your smartphone, they say. David, g'day. Hi, David.
Yeah, good evening. I just wanted to know whether imagination or being eccentric, for example, Salvador Dali, with his thing of surrealism, would you class someone like Salvador Dali a gifted? Because he really changed the whole thing of painting and his ideas. I'd just like your thoughts about imagination and also being eccentric.
Alan, what do you think about that?
I love that one. That's great. It really comes back to our discussion of giftedness being across multiple domains. And we've talked a lot about intellectual giftedness or cognitive giftedness tonight. But if you take that metric, that top 10% or that top 1%, and apply it to absolutely anything, you're still talking about giftedness. So it could be painting in some of the indigenous nations. We're really talking about leadership, or we're talking about cooking, or we're talking about the way that they interact with craft. It can be very, very different. So, of course, Salvador Dali would be in the top 1%, not just of capacity, not just of giftedness, but also the top 1% of performance. And for that reason, I would also put him in the category of genius.
Mm. Alan from Townsville said that Alan Turing solved several of what was considered unsolvable maths problems in one weekend. What's the long-running maths problem? Fermat's last theorem, isn't it? I think that's been solved now, though, hasn't it? Has Terence Tao had a crack at that, I wonder? Anyway, Melinda, are we saying anything more here, in a sense, than all children ought to be supported, including kids who are smart?
That's really the summary of it. Yes, absolutely. All children should be supported, and all children should have their needs met each and every day. When we discuss gifted education, particularly when we're having these discussions within our STOAD Association and our National Association, the discussions aren't to bring giftedness at the forefront to say, okay, giftedness is more important than all these other learners, for example. It's actually just to raise awareness to say, hey, let's not forget about these 10% of children, because we don't have this a national gifted policy. We don't have resourcing that's in around giftedness. And, only a glance at the 2018 PISA results that were released last December in 2019, you know, once again, Australia is continuing on the decline in our PISA results in those top levels, although reading has plateaued somewhat. So it's not about, promoting discussing giftedness and celebrating giftedness is not to be seen at the detriment of other learners, but it's to be seen as it's time we've paid attention.
Mm. Yes, there's no way of predicting what's going to happen either. One of my texters says, Dad's oldest brother was an autistic savant. He was able to recite entire movies, but he could not tie his shoelaces. Dad came second in the state at the equivalent of the HSC, and his twin brother came 10th. One of my brothers is a physio, and I'm a data scientist, but one of my brothers far exceeded us in IQ, but he's never amounted to anything. Left school because he was bored. Yes, it's not a clear path, is it? It's an interesting topic, and I suppose one of the other things is we celebrate and give thanks and take joy from the achievements of humans at all levels, don't we, Melinda and Alan? Particularly those who can write operas at age seven, and you really hope at age 27 they're still doing it. I guess. All right.
Yeah, absolutely.
We better leave it, Belinda, because we have unfortunately run out of time. But thanks for your time. I really appreciate it. It's been a fun conversation. Thank you. Melinda Gendy from the Gifted Family Support Group and Alan Thompson, who's a life coach. And thank you for the texts and calls as well.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.